Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've got a packed agenda today, and it's going to be a good one. The back end of the show, we are going to be talking with filmmaker Liz Kanner about her film, her new documentary, Orgasm, Inc., which is really a very compelling, very horrifying, very enraging film about the dehumanization of women, not just by the drug companies, but also by this whole warped male fantasy that seems to control a lot of the way women get treated in this society. Before that, we'll be talking with Deborah Sweet, the director of World Can't Wait, and we'll be talking about what's going on in Libya. She recently wrote an article called There Is No Humanitarian Intervention in Libya, and she tells me she's gotten hell for that article. But I'm really happy about this, our first guest. I've been waiting to have her on the show since I first started reading her book. Her name is Sikivu Hutchinson. She's the author of Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Values War. And it's really a remarkable book, an important and critical contribution to the discussion, the debate around atheism, humanism, values, gender politics, all of this stuff, the oppression of women, the role of religion and church in people's lives. And it's really a remarkable book, one that I really highly recommend that people get out there and read. Sikivu, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael.
Well, let's jump into this because I got so much to talk about off of reading your book, man.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Let's talk about first the state of affairs regarding religion in the black community. You mentioned that it's one of the most religious communities in the country. And can you talk about what is the state of affairs there? What is it? How deep does religion go in the black community?
Well, very deep. And there was a report done by the Pew Religion Research Forum that indicated that African Americans are the most religious community in the United States. About 87% of African Americans identify with some kind of religious persuasion. The predominant religious persuasion, obviously, is Christianity, with smaller numbers identifying with Catholicism, Islam, and other designations. So you have a very large contingent of African American communities that are steeped in religion. And we can really look at the trajectory of religiosity vis-a-vis a number of things. Obviously, the degree to which African Americans were compulsorily made to convert to Christianity, during the era of the slaveocracy, and the way in which religion really provided a moral foundation, a communal foundation, a sustaining force within African American families and communities vis-a-vis questions of personhood, questions of liberation struggle, questions of human rights. So we have that legacy moving into, obviously, the modern civil rights movement, where religion played a huge role in all of the organizing within African-American communities, all of the issues of attempting to gain enfranchisement and civil rights and citizenship. And also, providing for black women a space of a civil resistance and a space of trying to construct subjectivity, personhood, and agency. So religion has functioned on multiple levels within African American communities. And in the book, I really try to highlight how the embedding of religiosity, a conservative religiosity within contemporary African American communities, is really a function of how deep and intractable de facto segregation has been in our communities. And we look at the degree to which there aren't any real in inner city communities that have been severely, quote, underdeveloped and disenfranchised, that the diminishing of the social welfare net has really strengthened and deeply embedded religiosity in ways that have been very insidious for LGBT African Americans, African American women, obviously non-believers, those who are not encompassed within this vision of a quote-unquote authentic essentialist African American community.
We're talking with Sikivu Hutchinson about her new book, Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Value Wars. And this is something I want to pursue a little bit more in this conversation, is the question of the role of the church in the black community. And along the lines of what you've been talking about, the whole idea of this social service role, for instance, and the umbrella of support that it provides in these communities, there's a positive and a negative aspect to that. I mean, there's one thing that certainly I understand that the need for, you know, what people find in terms of the, you know, the need to get, you know, whether it's, I don't know, whatever kind of social support that comes out of that, as well as the idea, you also talk about the assertion of community, the finding of community, of humanity in resisting dehumanization, both historically and currently. But there's also a very negative side to this, which I thought you really draw out in a very compelling way, too. What is that negative? For instance, with the social service role, you know, there's the actual attending to the needs of people, but then there's also very much the idea of, for instance, things like the faith-based initiatives, which promote and develop and strengthen the bonds of religion in the black community.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So I think that this can be examined in a number of ways. And in the book, I really attempt to dig into how this hyper-religiosity is very insidious, very pernicious for African-American women. Because I think within mainstream discourse, the black church and black women's role within the black church has always been positioned as, again, this is a space of a civil resistance. It's a space for women to come to voice, to achieve some degree of political agency and subjectivity. But if we deconstruct it a little more deeply and look at Scripture and the degree to which Scripture dehumanizes and really embeds misogyny into the overarching dynamic of religious communities and the provision of social services, then it becomes a little bit more problematic to posit that this institution has been liberatory for black women. If we look at issues like mental health and wellness and the degree to which church social services try to mediate issues of mental health and wellness with African-American women, this issue of the black female being a self-sacrificing caregiver, first and foremost, a mother above all, a provider and protector of home and hearth, has really been undermining for black women's liberation. Because if you look at mental health in terms of we need to shore up, you know, black women's caregiving, we need to shore up, you know, black women's obeisance to this idea of black masculinity as being the be-all, end-all paradigm for the salvation of African-American communities. That is really a big recurring theme within the provision of mental health and wellness resources within the black church. So in order to really deconstruct that aspect with regard to, again, the way in which it has been disenfranchising for African-American women, my posit is let's look at a secular humanist approach to black women's subjectivity. And that secular humanist approach to black women's subjectivity would then be, in my view, more enfranchising, more reinforcing for the black community as a whole.
You also say, in relation to this, I think, the idea that if you go and you're talking about a secular humanist and atheist approach, if you're taking that into the black community, you actually, at one point, I really liked your phrase here, that it was sort of like putting on a white sheet and waving a Confederate flag, and that in order to bring this, you're really going to go up against a lot of oppositional forces, including what you describe as the Jesus train. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that the black hyper-religiosity cannot be viewed in the vacuum. I mean, let's look at the United States, for instance, and the fact that this is hands down, you know, the most hyper-religious, the most obsessively, you know, fixated on this idea of Christianity as being the space of redemption. And that nationalist dynamic to Christianity is something that I think is extremely dangerous and obviously feeds into the institutionalization of white supremacy in this nation. So the interesting thing is that, yes, the black church has been a bulwark against that, has been a means for positioning African-American liberatory resistance against that. But if we look at the more conservative elements of that in terms of the construction and articulation of, again, gender and sexuality, of the identity of families that go beyond this heterosexist, patriarchal, hierarchical, in my view, fascistic model of family, that is going to be very dangerous when we talk about what constitutes authentic black identity. There have been, as I point out, scores and scores of major African-American intellectuals, thinkers, activists, and organizers who have espoused secular humanist social justice principles, you know, in their literature, in their organizing, in the community, you know, in their criticism of American imperialist and colonialist policies in the third world. But that's been marginalized within the broader trajectory of quote-unquote African-American history, and certainly within the broader trajectory of American history, the canonical version of what American history is. And it has everything to do with the consolidation of these very hierarchical and fascistic notions of gender, the family, masculinity, femininity, and sexuality and reproduction. So I try to bring that out in the book, and again tying it to, like you said, how there's going to be just reflexive backlash and pushback against making that critique and looking at how secular humanism can be a reality in terms of social services within African-American communities, in terms of educational practices within African-American communities, in terms of a different approach to science literacy within African-American communities.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sikivu Hutchinson, the author of Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Values War. Now, Sikivu, one of the things that follows up on this in terms of the role of the church, for instance, in social justice causes, you know, the idea is, and it's true that there's been a very active church, more so in the past, I think, in a certain sense, especially in the 60s when there was a mass upsurge of people, and, you know, in that whole period against Jim Crow, against segregation, against the oppression that was coming down on the 60s really characterized a period of mass resistance, and with oftentimes a revolutionary direction. And the church, the black church played a role in that, but at the same time, I think, you know, and I'd like to examine this a little bit, because even back then, while it was playing a role at that, there was an element of that, and I think a big element of it, which was also reining people in. Don't go too far. And today, absolutely, it's very rare for the black churches to actually take on some of the critical cutting-edge questions that are out there in society today.
Yeah. So in the book, I talk about the imminence, unfortunately, of the prosperity gospel and the degree to which, you know, the prosperity gospel has really, unfortunately, become the de facto face of the black church within mainstream American society. And we certainly saw that with the whole upheaval around the Eddie Long controversy. And Eddie Long is the pastor of, I think it's a New Birth Church in Atlanta, and he was accused of abusing male parishioners in his congregation and has been notorious for basically living this baronial capitalistic lifestyle with fleets of cars and private jets and baronial estates, you know, and really reaping the rewards of Bush's faith-based initiative regime. So that, unfortunately, has become the face of the 21st century black church. And there are obviously, you know, progressive religious left voices within the black church, but those voices have been muted. They've been muted because we have, unfortunately, this unholy alliance between those very conservative reactionary forces within black church faith communities and the white Christian fundamentalist activist regime. So we see that manifested in the abortion as black genocide campaign that, unfortunately, has mushroomed throughout communities of color nationwide. We see that in this pushback against LGBT equality and LGBT liberation, i.e. all of the movement around Proposition 8 and the degree to which black churches, you know, were very visible in mobilizing to support Proposition 8. So that, unfortunately, has become the activist face of the black church in the 21st century. And then if we harken back to the early 20th century, and I get into this a little bit in the book, A. Philip Randolph, who was an eminent socialist organizer, a civil rights and human rights activist, who also espoused secular humanist principles, met with a lot of pushback from very conservative reactionary forces in the black faith community when he was attempting to, with his colleagues and other organizers, establish the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And the reaction against Randolph was due to his revolutionary politics. So, again, there has been a prominent vein of conservatism within black church, black faith communities that cannot be reconciled with the more liberationist aspects.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Sikivu Hutchinson, author of Moral Combat,
Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Value Wars.
Now, let me dig into this a little bit, because you also, again, speaking about the, you're very active in black humanists, black secular skeptics, atheist groupings, associations, societies, and you have a relationship in somewhat of a relationship overall with the mainstream, if there is such a thing as mainstream. Boy, that'll be the day we can talk about the mainstream thinking being atheism.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, exactly. But the idea, you know, that the dominant stream of new atheism that's out there in the world today. You have a relationship with that grouping of people. You also have some differences. And one of them is you make the point that you think that if anyone is going to be bringing atheism into a black community, that they have to proceed from understanding the context of the role and influence of religion in that community. And I'd like to talk to you about that, because I also think that raises something that Bob Avakian talks to in Away With All Gods, which is this idea of heart in a heartless world, and that religion actually does provide that, but that actually isn't necessarily a good thing, because really, well, you know, you can understand the importance of that. There's also the idea that the world doesn't have to be this way, and in fact, religion, part of its consoling role, actually helps hold people back from getting to a whole new world.
Yeah. So with regard to the trajectory of the new atheist movement, one of my principal bones of contention has been what I perceive to be a very paternalistic, very condescending attitude towards African-American religious traditions. And again, emanating from ignorance, emanating from an unacknowledged white supremacy on the part of those doing the criticizing. And in the book, I try to unpack the colonialist legacies, not just of the establishment of a Christian, a Judeo-Christian dogma and ideology in the United States, but also scientific racism, how scientific racism was deeply intertwined with colonialist imposition of religion on African peoples and other peoples of color in the United States. And the real swaggering ignorance on the part of new atheists has been, well, African Americans are basically subscribing to this backward doctrine that dehumanizes and subordinates them. Why would they be doing this? That it's nonsensical. It points to the anti-science orientation of African Americans, the lack of science literacy within the community, and the primary antidote to that would be to basically propagandize that evolution and a scientific materialist take on the creation of the universe is going to be the best remedy for this kind of backward, antediluvian, and provincial thinking. So I dig into the white supremacy of that kind of impulse. I also look at the degree to which black women's bodies have been the battleground for colonialist enterprise and religious enterprise, and the way in which the intersection of colonialist, scientific, and religious enterprise was really a means for establishing and articulating Western models of what it meant to be human. And so I think some of the embedded impulse of religious adherence in African American communities is due to this attempt to intervene within that narrative, to intervene within that regime of establishing what humanity has been. Humanity has always been measured on Western European empirical terms.
Well, again, you know, you have a situation where all that's true, and I would agree with much of that. You know, and I understand you're saying that we can't be mechanically scientific about this in the sense of just sort of science determines this and this and this and this, and that there's not a great interplay between, you know, science and what's real, and actually even science understanding what's real in the communities and everything else. But still, that idea of, and, you know, you cited Marx, and that's why I went to this heart in a heartless world, because there's something intangible about religion, but at the same time, and a lot of times that's the salve kind of thing that's going on. And even if it is the question of historical community and humanization and all this other very important concepts, at the same time, isn't there a responsibility that people have to actually try and get in there and struggle with people to rupture away from that kind of putting the salve on the wound and to really understand what's going on and what it's going to take to change things?
Yeah, I agree with that. But I try and frame the hyper-religious impulse in terms of the extreme disenfranchisement that we see within African-American communities because of the institutionalization of residential segregation. The idea that black churches have been a means of solace, they've been a sanctuary, not just in terms of spirituality, but in terms of culture. So in order to really deconstruct the hold that religious traditions and religious ideologies have on African-American peoples, there needs to be some connection to liberation struggle within the context of trying to dismantle the capitalist exploitation of inner-city communities, trying to dismantle the hyper-masculinist and patriarchal hold and domination that religious scripture and secular culture have on African-American communities. So I think that the solution is intersectional.
All right, Sakivu, on that note, we're going to have to begin to wrap this up. I do want to tell people that there's actually a very, very intriguing chapter at the end of your book on the road ahead. Unfortunately, we're running out of time and we won't be able to approach that. Sakivu, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay, talk to you again soon. We've been talking with Sakivu Hutchinson, author of Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Value Wars. And I'm Michael Slate, and this is the Michael Slate Show. We are going to take a short break and be right back with Deborah Sweet, the director of World Can't Wait, talking about the U.S. intervention in Libya.
Red and swollen tears tumble from her eyes, while cold silver birds who came to cruise the skies send death down to bend and twist her tiny hands, and then proceed to target B in keeping with their plans. Khaki priests of Christendom, interpreters of love, ride a stone leviathan across a sea of blood, and pound their feet into the sand of shores they've never seen. Delegates from the western land to join the death machine. And we send cards and letters. The oxen lie beside the road, their bodies baked in mud, and fat flies chew out their eyes, then bathe themselves in blood. And superheroes fill the skies, tally sheets in hand. Yes, keeping score in times of war takes a Superman. The junk crawls past hidden death, its cargo shakes inside, and soldier children hold their breath and kill them as they hide. And those who took so long to learn the subtle ways of death lie and bleed in paddy mud with questions on their breath. And we send prayers and praises.
And that was An Untitled Protest from Country Joe and the Fish, one of the least known and most powerful anti-war songs I've ever heard. Couldn't ask for a more appropriate introduction to this segment and a more appropriate comment on what's going on in the world today, especially in relation to Libya. Joining us now is Deborah Sweet, director of World Can't Wait and author of a recent article called There Is No Humanitarian Intervention in Libya. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into it. You told me with this article that you wrote, There Is No Humanitarian Intervention in Libya, that you've gotten a hellified response. A lot of people questioning and fighting with you about that. What did the article say, and why are they fighting?
Well, first of all, you know, it kind of goes with the job description of The World Can't Wait. We used to be trying to drive out the Bush regime. We caught a lot of hell from that. We really caught hell when we started criticizing Obama even before he became the president, and when we criticized Afghanistan. So this is a pattern. You know, the article merely quoted a number of people who are critics of this U.S. intervention in Libya. I don't claim any expertise about Libya and North Africa or all of the history, but I do have some expertise in moral combat. I love listening to Tsukuba, and the title of her book is, I think, something that we have to apply quite widely right now. And I guess what I found out from the response to the article is that a lot of people are very confused about this particular intervention. It's been sold, of course, by the Obama administration as a humanitarian effort. And if I've been told, well, if you really care about saving people's lives, you'll support anything the U.S. would do that. It's also been sold, and I think this is a lot truer, as something that the U.S. needs to do for its own vital national interest. And I guess maybe, like other people who are listening, whenever I hear that phrase, the vital interests of the United States, I say, whoa, who are we talking about here? To me, this whole enterprise of Libya in particular just feels like Western neocolonialism. It does feel like the Western powers coming in and staking claim to a Libya that they want to be compliant and the riches of in Libya and the gateway to Africa, which is of course has always been a huge prize for the imperialists. I'm just raising questions.
Okay, I'm not going to fight with you. Well, here's a question though. I'll raise my own question here. You know, here's the point. I think that I remember back to Yugoslavia, and where the left in this country was, in a shameful way, basically marched behind Bill Clinton and his bombing of Yugoslavia, citing Serbia, Bosnia, all this, that there somebody needed to step in and stop this atrocious, slaughter. And, these people, the people who run this society, who run this system, are hardly people who are really concerned about the human rights of people around the world. And here, but especially in the third world, there's not a lot of concern for that. And as we've seen over and over, including one of the things that I think I was telling you yesterday, that Samantha Power was talking about being, or somebody was talking about seeing Susan Rice, who's now the UN representative, was part of the Clinton administration and sitting in a meeting about Rwanda and the genocide in Rwanda and actually sort of musing out loud about, what do you think the political cost of allowing the Rwandans to just kill each other would be?
Here's part of where the great confusion is. First of all, I and others have been trying to point out the U.S. is very deliberate in where it intervenes. It is hardly intervening in the most egregious cases of the slaughter of civilians. Otherwise, it would have intervened in other places. However, that should not make us argue for U.S. intervention in these situations. Be careful what you wish for. In fact, what does happen when they intervene? Look at Haiti. In 1994, that was Operation Restore Democracy, or Restore Freedom. They always have these operation names that are very Orwellian. Or look at Somalia, also in the 90s, both under Clinton. The Democrats have led some interventions in oppressed countries that have been completely horrific and have never resulted in a better situation for the masses of people there. So I do think we have to look at history, and that should help begin to clear up some of this confusion. But I also think, besides, there certainly is confusion. And people can find out, can read. I have some ideas I want to point out on where to go. But there's also paralysis, and part of this paralysis is the same thing with Clinton going after Kosovo, is you have Obama leading the charge in Libya and doing it on the basis of, the Nobel Prize winner, the person who's concerned with human rights. And this is actually making people be way too quiet. People haven't found even their moral stance to condemn this.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Deborah Sweet, the director of World Can't Wait, and we're talking about the U.S. intervention in Libya and what's the real nature of that. Not humanitarian response, I'll tell you that. Deborah,
we should be having protests, but we should be the moral voices in this country should be condemning this in one voice.
I couldn't agree more. And part of the thing is, though, I think actually the confusion, there's a point of people really understanding. Like Juan Cole, for instance, and I know you're familiar with this, he just did an open letter to the left on Libya, where he argues that, and in a very snarky kind of way, he argues saying, well, you know, there's a whole, I just want to see the U.S., I want to see the movement in this country be able to chew gum and walk at the same time, as, you know, and arguing that there's a much more nuanced approach to the world that we have to take. And invariably, I was convinced after reading that, that what this guy doesn't quite get is that, in fact, the U.S. doesn't have humanitarian responses. It doesn't respond to things on the basis of caring about humanity, but it has very real imperial interests, which aren't even, in Libya's case, aren't even confined to whether or not they want to get the oil in Libya. There's actually a whole geopolitical strategy that's at stake there.
Absolutely. This is a sovereign country that the U.S. and NATO and France and the U.K. are mucking around in. They are really going to bring disaster for the people. We don't know how this is going to turn out, but there's more and more commitment. And, of course, they're in there with secret operatives. That's been the case for a long time. Look, here's the difference. Egypt, you have this huge mass uprising, right? People are watching it on TV. And what does the Obama administration come out and say? Well, you know, Mubarak is our solid ally. They stuck with that for weeks and weeks. And then, yes, they finally did give him the boot. But they were not so concerned because they had the Egyptian military, who is now firmly, apparently, in control of that country. And that is really bad news for the people there, especially the youth and the women, who are not going to be let into, you know, making change. But Gaddafi is a different matter. The U.S. does not have that level of control of Gaddafi and the military, and it's a much more wide-open situation fraught with a lot of different possibilities. Why should the interests of people living in this country be tied to the U.S. military and geostrategic interests? They just never have been before. And I really do think we've got to look back at history and see what these interventions have always meant, all the way down the line. And yes, chew gum, be aware, use some science and our own powers of observation here. It's as if people like Juan Cole are saying, okay, I understand there's a serial murderer here, but maybe this time it could turn out differently. Maybe this time. People have argued that to me, and I said, well, you know, that would be certainly a striking difference, but this is surely not the case in Libya. Nothing good is going to come out of this intervention. And I'd really urge people to look at, you know, we're putting on worldcan'twait.net a lot of different voices. People, the Black Agenda Report has been very critical of this intervention. They have different voices up. Glenn Greenwald from Salon.com, Revolution Newspaper, World Can't Wait. We're trying to pull out the sources of exposure and also the moral condemnation here so that people feel like they have some backbone when they speak up. So any of the listeners here want to join with me, I'm really calling for people to come out very publicly and take this apart, stand against it. And who says this is going to stop in Libya? Who says this is going to be confined to some national borders of a country with a fairly small population? This has the potential to be not only just as bad as the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, but to spread much more widely. And we are the break on that. The masses of people, certainly in those countries, and what they do is extremely important. But we're responsible for the crimes of our own government.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Deborah Sweet, the director of World Can't Wait. That's an extremely important point, and that's one of the things we're going to have to wrap up in about 3 minutes, but I wanted to actually dig into that a little bit because this idea of paralysis is extremely important. You look at what they've been doing in Libya and the kind of, you know, the bombing and the rocket, you know, rockets coming in and the portrayal of, you know, Gaddafi, who is a butcher, but the portrayal of him is like this insane madman akin to Hitler and all this. And we've got to go in and stop him because he's really destroying the people. And then you listen to the stuff that they're doing where they're talking about they're not ruling out off the table the idea that they will arm the opposition. They're actually talking about they have had the CIA working on the ground in Libya since the very beginning. He just signed this secret thing about they could do, you know, they could actually intervene. They could provide covert assistance, you know, and they're not, you know, all these things are lining up and people, I mean, it's paralysis. It's really enraging that people are not out in the streets in a way. And it goes along with this whole thing of, you know, people have accepted so much over so many years and especially under Obama that it's just, it just is enraging and it really needs to stop.
Well, I mean, even people who are very much committed to, you know, let's do this legally and with proper procedure and so forth, I've had people argue to me that the problem here is that this is Obama moving unilaterally and he didn't bring Congress in on it. Well, the big problem with that is I am completely sure Congress would vote for this, right? Half of them are yelling that they want the intervention to be quicker, stronger, and more brutal. But the level of executive power that Obama is using, I mean, he really makes Bush look weak at this point. He is going full speed ahead, and you know, Clinton said the other day, basically Congress can pass what they want, we are doing this. The other thing that this is really important to bring in, sorry, the UN, this whole thing about, oh, we've got UN approval, come on. UN approval is used to cover terrible things. The UN has been against the slaughter of the Palestinians and the bombing of Gaza. That didn't stop anything. UN approval basically doesn't mean anything if the U.S. is bound and determined to do what it's going to do. And I will say that one argument I have found turned some people's minds around in the last couple of days is a fellow wrote to me and he said, look, the only thing I can think of is what about 2 years ago when the people of Gaza were being bombed by Israel? Why didn't the U.S. come in and stop that? You know, so I put that in my article, and a number of people have written me and said, you know, I really was sucked in by this humanitarian thing, but I got to think about the example of Gaza.
And on that note, Deborah, we're going
to... We were watching it, you know, and the U.S. didn't intervene. So this time the people have to intervene, Michael.
On that note, Deborah, we're going to have to wrap this up. Yes, you can say that again. Say that one little phrase again.
We have to speak up and stop this. Not in our name.
All right, Deborah. Thank you very much. Talk to you again soon.
Yeah, later. Bye.
Okay, take care. We've been talking with Deborah Sweet, the director of World Can't Wait, on the war in Libya, the U.S. intervention there. There's no humanitarian intervention and the need for people to break out of the paralysis and stop what is certainly yet another major war crime on the Obama administration and U.S. imperialism's part. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Liz Kanner, the director of Orgasm, Inc. Welcome back. Cyndi Lauper with Girls Just Want to Have Fun. And I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest, Liz Kanner, filmmaker, director of Orgasm, Inc., a fantastic film. I really like this film. It's a film that's funny, it's enlightening, and extremely enraging. And all that packed into one film. Liz, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on your show, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. I was thinking maybe we'll play the trailer a little bit later, but I actually really want to dig into this with you. The idea that, what the hell were you thinking when you started out to make this film?
Well, I really didn't want to make an expose on the medical industry. What happened was I had been producing documentaries for about a decade on human rights issues. And when you make documentaries, you watch the footage over and over again. And actually, I had produced a documentary on police brutality in the Los Angeles Police Department. That was one of the films I'd worked on. And I was starting to get nightmares from the footage and getting very depressed about the state of humanity. So I decided that my next film had to be on something uplifting. And then I thought, I want to have pleasurable dreams. So I started researching what medicine and science had been saying about women and sexual response and conception over the past few thousand years. And I was shooting this experimental historical documentary when out of the blue, I was offered a job at a pharmaceutical company that was developing an orgasm cream for women. And they needed someone to put together erotic videos and intercut it with asexual video. And we had a lot of conversations about what's asexual video. So we ended up intercutting erotic footage with documentary footage of doorstops and library cats. And the idea was that women were going to come into the doctor's office, they were going to watch these videos and apply the drug. And while I was working for this drug company, I asked them if I could film them because I thought, okay, this is going to give me a contemporary look at what science is saying about women and pleasure, what sort of breakthroughs that they're making. But what I actually discovered is that they really weren't making any breakthroughs at all. And the film ends up documenting the search for the female Viagra over a 9-year period and the attempt to really come up with something that would work for women. But I don't want to give it all away.
Right. But I do want to say, though, that it really is they did make some breakthroughs. They made breakthroughs in the audacious, bold, the over-the-top pushing out of some warped male fantasy, perverted fantasy about that has in terms of the role of women, the relationship between men and women, and it has a very deep impact on women's lives.
Right, right. Basically, what I discovered was, and I think what you're touching upon, is that the pharmaceutical industry is not just in the business of developing drugs. They've started to get into the business of also expanding our idea of what a disease actually is, so that everyday life problems start to be seen as something that's a disorder that you need a pill for, and lo and behold, they have the pill. So they've gotten into this business of something called condition branding, where they actually define the disorder, and then their drug is the one that you immediately think of. Like with erectile dysfunction, you think of Viagra. So there's this sort of this branding going on, this coupling. And in this case, the disorder was female sexual dysfunction that basically they had a hand in creating.
Liz, I'm going to play the trailer just so people can get a sense of the film overall, and then we can come back and talk about it. Is that all right with you?
Oh, sounds great.
Okay, let's play the trailer.
All of my life, I've had difficulty achieving orgasm.
It's a secret epidemic that 43% of American women experience sexual dysfunction.
40 million women in the United States alone may be affected by female sexual dysfunction.
Actually, there are more sexual dysfunctions in women than there are in men.
Female sexual dysfunction probably runs 83%.
This is a very new field of medicine, but there's a good chance the problem can be tackled.
Vivas wanted me to put together erotic video for use during the testing of their new drug.
Now you'll be going to the sensory testing room where the physician will monitor blood flow to the genitals.
Little did I know that I would spend 9 years documenting the medical industry's attempt to change our understanding of the meaning of health, illness, desire, and orgasm.
The market out there is large. Who will buy it?
We're all in a race to see who can be first to market.
Your total today is $1,500. We take cash, check, or charge.
There's a lot of money to be made telling healthy people they're sick.
Is a drug going to help them? Maybe if it has a map of the clitoris on the box.
We, as a society, think that we should be able to fix everything by just taking a pill. It's not a disease.
Health costs are already exploding. Drug companies have been involved in redefining and designing conditions.
I see today as a perilous moment in the history of women's sexuality.
There was an increase in breast cancer. There was a doubling in the rate of dementia.
So when the FDA said yes...
Yes.
It started a gold rush as inventors searched for cures.
We're going to call the device the orgasmotron. The electrode is threaded up the spinal cord. And then by adjusting the electrical parameters, you will have an orgasm.
Ooh. Oh, that's too strong.
We use the laser to make an incision. We're able to push the bladder back up to where normally in a young person it would be, making it tighter.
My doctor said that I lost about a third of my blood volume. There was a possibility of me dying.
It was heady days, though. I mean, you watched the stock price go up every day.
We didn't even know what the disease was.
It does, being for men, it does sort of the same thing for women.
Viagra.
How did female sexual dysfunction come to be as a disease?
We don't know.
Give me enough time to find a new job before you air this.
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Liz Kanner, the filmmaker and director of Orgasm, Inc., and that was the trailer for Orgasm, Inc. Wow, Liz. I have to say, you know, as I'm sitting here and I'm laughing because of the absurdity of it, and yet the very real pain and perverted, you know, nature of this whole thing. I mean, even that the invention of a disease, and then the idea that the marketing of drugs that actually and concepts that actually dehumanize women to the maximum degree, all in the name of profit. It's astounding, and it shouldn't be, but it is. It's sort of
right. Right, I think that's true. I mean, it basically, you know, what happened was in the late 90s when Viagra was such a blockbuster drug for Pfizer, they wanted to test it on women because they thought there was going to be a much bigger market there. So they hired the person that came up with the doctors that would be at this meeting. They had a consultant who put together the list, and the meeting, they came up with female sexual dysfunction. 18 of the 19 doctors who came up with the disorder had ties to 22 drug companies. And the disorder basically encompasses any sexual complaint that you might have. And the reason that they needed to do this was that the FDA actually requires that there's a legitimate disease in order to test a drug. And so Pfizer wanted to test Viagra on women, and the drug company that I worked for wanted to test their drug on women. They had a drug for erectile dysfunction as well. And the belief was that these drugs were going to work. I'm not sure if they ever asked a woman, because it's not something that we actually pay attention to, whether or not we're engorged. But they were hopeful, and the clinical trials actually proved correctly, you know, that women don't care if they're engorged, even if they are. And so those drugs, they stopped the clinical trials. But there are many drug companies out there still racing to come up with something to help women around this. But, you know, I think that the problem is right now that, you know, there are a few women that do have medical conditions that can cause sexual problems, such as diabetes can affect orgasm. If you've had a radical hysterectomy, that can affect libido. If you're on antidepressants, that can affect libido and orgasmic function, and so can the birth control pill, actually. They're finding that it can lower libido for some women. But the reality is that most women are healthy, and we as a public are not going to be protected from the sort of marketing of female sexual dysfunction and the drugs to supposedly cure it, so that a lot of healthy women will probably end up on drugs that don't need them, if anything's ever approved. We are the only country in the world, besides New Zealand, that actually allows direct-to-consumer advertising. And this is something that's fairly recent. In the late 90s, there was a lot more deregulation, and that's why we're inundated with the drug ads that we are. So, you know, we're in this real problem in our culture where we have turned into this pill-popping nation because drugs are being advertised to us like cars. And so that's really the concern here, that healthy women who don't need some of these drugs, and the ones that they're proposing are quite strong, some of them have side effects like breast cancer and cardiovascular problems, could end up on these things, and they don't need them. Sexual problems are often much more relationship-based, and past history of sexual abuse and that kind of thing have an effect.
Well, you know, one thing, it really does strike me, this idea. I mean, I'm listening to that idiot talk about the orgasmatron. I'm like, is this guy for real? I mean, Woody Allen, decades ago, had an orgasmatron. Everybody laughed at, and this guy's coming out and actually marketing it as some kind of magic, you know, wand that will suddenly do away with all the things that, not just the medical things, but frankly, even the point that you make in the film, that, and that a number of people in the film make, is that a lot of sexual problems that women have in sexual relations, that a lot of the problems they have actually has a lot more to do with the quality of the relationship and the quality of themselves interacting with the person that they're having a relationship with. And that is something, instead of portraying instead of creating what to me seems to be yet another step in the direction of Stepford Wives, the idea of actually taking, you know, as I think one of the people in your film points to a cartoon that has a thing about, I wonder if they're going to develop a pill to stimulate conversation. You know, so Stepford Wives versus taking an approach that would actually be much more recognizing the humanity and equality of women.
Right, right. I think that's part of the problem here, that we right now are looking to medical solutions for things that are really societal issues. The fact that so many women are still sexually abused. And that has a big effect on your experience down the road in terms of pleasure, how much pleasure you can experience. And sex therapy has been found to really help women who have been sexually abused. But, you know, and I think, you know, in terms of relationship issues, that we as a society are not that comfortable weirdly around sex. We teach abstinence only in the schools. And at the same time, young people start looking at pornography on average at the age of 11. So we're very schizophrenic when it comes to sex, and that has an effect on our relationships and what we feel comfortable talking about. And so I think that all of these things are really a factor, and certainly relationships between men and women, there's still some issues around, you know, who's doing work around the house. I always say chore play is a wonderful cure and leads to foreplay, which they've even done studies leads to better sex. So I think, you know, sharing the chores around the house can make a big difference. I mean, there are certainly things that have been found to work that don't require medical interventions. But you know, sort of getting back to your comment earlier, I do worry as a society in general that we are taking many pills to try and cover up bigger issues that we need to address. And I think this is why so many people are on antidepressants. You know, there are real reasons to be upset, you know, given what's happened with our economy and the wars that we're in and everything that's going on. And I think that we need to address those things instead of trying to sort of medicalize ourselves around all of these issues.
A quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Liz Kanner, award-winning filmmaker and the director of a really impressive new film, Orgasm, Inc., on the dehumanization and objectification of women and the role of the big drug companies and medical capitalism in this. Well, you know, one thing, too, that was one of the most striking things to me about this, and one of the saddest things, is that you also realize through the run of this film, through the course of this film, you come to realize how much. And it's not just us. I mean, there's a them and there's an us in the sense of, you know, and yes, a lot of people in this society who aren't them actually take up the dominant ethos in the society. But there's a system that's pushing this. And I think one of the things that it does that is unforgivable in any sense, and for people to take it up, it's unforgivable, is the idea of the promoting to women that their entire humanity, their entire being is wrapped up in their sexual activity, their ability to be sexually appealing, to have orgasms, to have a fun sexual relationship. It becomes everything. And there's one person in your film who is so eaten up by that she's willing to risk some of the worst things out there. And you also make a point about women who are willing to, you know, undergo genital mutilation in order to be part of this overall stream of I am what my sexuality is.
Right. I think that, you know, there's a lot of pressure on women to perform sexually. And one thing that I found in making Orgasm, Inc. is that on the one hand, we are supposed to be orgasmic all the time. On the other hand, we don't really have good sex education. We don't teach about the clitoris in our sex ed classes. We don't teach the fact that vaginas are all very different and a lot of them are asymmetrical, and that's totally normal. We are very limited in the sort of knowledge that we actually convey in our culture. And so many women have this false notion that they're supposed to be having an orgasm every time they have heterosexual intercourse. And the reality is that 70% of women need direct clitoral stimulation in order to have an orgasm. And when I was filming this woman, Charletta, who actually allowed an orgasmatron to be put into her spine, it was an electrode connected to a wire that's controlled by this remote control device kind of thing that's supposed to stimulate an orgasm. And this was actually a clinical trial of this device. And the surgery that I filmed was actually quite harrowing and disturbing. And at the end, when I was interviewing her, I asked her if she could have orgasms through other means. And I discovered that she could. And when I told her that 70% of women actually need direct clitoral stimulation in order to have an orgasm,
she became completely shocked, and she realized that she was completely normal. And yet she had been enrolled in this clinical trial for people with female sexual dysfunction. So I think it also shows how easy it is to mislead women into thinking that they have this disorder when perhaps they're perfectly fine.
And on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up, Liz. We've just run out of time. But I want to thank you very much for the film and really enjoyed talking with you.
Yes, thank you so much, and I hope everyone goes to check it out.
Don't miss it. Liz, take care.
Yes, thank you so much, Michael.
All right, bye now. All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've been talking with Liz Kanner, the director of the film Orgasm, Inc. And I want to, I want to let people know that just one thing in relation to what we've been talking about. Here's a quote from a new book called Basics from Bob Avakian, the works and writings of Bob Avakian. It says, Western morality, and for that matter, the dominant morality in all parts of the world, wherever society is marked by class division and exploitation, patriarchy and other forms of oppression, has always been a rationale and justification for oppression. Don't forget it. That's from Basics. You can't change the world if you don't know the basics. It's a new book from Bob Avakian. You can order it on Amazon.com or go to your local bookstore and say, hey, you got this book, Basics? If they don't have it, tell them they need to get it so you can read it and spread it around. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I want to thank my production assistant, Henry Carson. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in. And keep coming back each week. You know where to find us. We live right here at the intersection of epistemology and morality. This is the spot where we know that it's not okay to not look at something or to not accept something just because it makes us feel uncomfortable. By the same token, it's not okay to accept something or to believe something just because it makes us feel comfortable. We got to change the world. We got to know the world. And once we know the world, we got to change it. And it is inevitable that you're going to come up on a time where epistemology does meet morality. If you know something is wrong, you got to change it. If you know something is right, you got to act on it. All right. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song from the Slackers. You know, this is a group I just stumbled back onto a little while ago, and I'm really wild about their music. And this piece is called Crazy, so listen up. It's Crazy from the Slackers.
Every day I'm living in a world gone crazy.